Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian. He led his flock beyond the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. There the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of a bush. He looked, and the bush was blazing, yet it was not consumed. Then Moses said, "I must turn aside and look at this great sight and see why the bush is not burned up." When the Lord saw that he had turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush, "Moses, Moses." And he said, "Here I am." Then he said, "Come no closer. Remove the sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground." He said further, "I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. Then the Lord said, "I have observed the misery of my people who are in Egypt. I have heard their cry on account of their taskmasters. Indeed, I know their sufferings. And I have come down to deliver them from the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey. So come, I will send you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt." But Moses said to God, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt?" God said, "I will be with you." This is the word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God. You may be seated.
As you're seated, I invite you to please take out of your bulletin your insert that says Journey Through the Old Testament, and then also take out the map, if you would. Now, the insert that says Journey Through the Old Testament is our sermon notes and study guide, and you have a chance to write down the notes that you'd like to remember and reflect upon. You're going to learn some things today, and you'll probably want to just remember those things. And maybe somewhere in here, you'll feel like God is speaking to you, and you'll want to write that down so you can continue to reflect on it. On the back side, you'll find our study guide, which is an invitation for you to read the Bible on your own this week. And we're studying the Old Testament. You're going to have a chance to read some of the great stories of the Old Testament. I want to encourage you to take this home with you. And then when it comes to the maps, if you'll hold this in your lap as well, we're going to be referring to the top map, and then next week we'll be looking at the next map down, the bottom map. And so I want to encourage you, put this in your Bible or somewhere where you'll remember to bring it back next week, because we won't reprint this bottom map next week. But both of these maps will be useful, the top one for today. Well, Thursday of this week, USA Today ran an article by Kathy Lynn Grossman entitled, "Americans Get an F in Religion." And what she was noting was the research of a Boston University professor who studied how much Americans actually know about their own religion and other people's religions. And what they found was that even religious people in America tended to not know very much about their own Bible, their own stories, their own theology. They noted that 60% of all Americans couldn't name five or more of the Ten Commandments. And so given that information, they're suggesting that this really is a challenge for us. Even if you're not a believer, it's a challenge because we live in a culture that is immersed in religion. And so much of what happens in the world today is in some way shaped by religion. And so whether you're a believer or not, it's important to you, it's important for our society that you understand some of the basic tenets of religion and some of the basic stories. And that's part of the reason why I'm taking you on a journey right now during the season of Lent through the Old Testament. My aim has been to expose you to the overarching story of the Bible, of the Old Testament, to help you understand its major characters, to understand the major themes, and in this way to encourage you. In fact, my hope is each week after the sermon you go, "I want to go read more, I want to study more," and then you become more and more familiar with the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament. And my aim, ultimately, is that you don't get an F in religion, but that you've got an A, or at least a B+, in the area of religion. So, we're going to take the time today to continue our journey through the Old Testament. We begin 2 weeks ago when we studied the entire Hebrew Bible, the entire Old Testament in 33 minutes. And that was kind of a broad overview, an orientation, if you will. And then last week we turned to the book of Genesis, the foundational stories, and we looked at the creation story and particularly the Abraham story. And you remember, of course, that both Judaism, Christianity, and Islam trace their origins back to Abraham. Today we pick up where Genesis left off. We look at the next four books of what's called the Pentateuch, the five scrolls. So the first five books, we studied the first one. The next four, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. And by the time you're finished, you'll know what happens in each of those books and what the storyline is, and then a little bit about what Moses' life might mean for our lives today. Let's begin by taking a journey through these four books. And if I could, what I'd really love to do is load you all up on 747s and we'd all travel over to the Holy Land. And we'd start in Cairo, actually, not the Holy Land, we'd start in Egypt. And we would actually walk in the footsteps of the Israelites. You can do that and you can see the places that they visited. And I'd like to sort of take you on that journey today. Let's take a look at the map. And I want to remind you that when the book of Genesis ended last week, as we got to the end of the book of Genesis, we found that the Israelites had been welcomed as guests in Egypt into the land of Goshen, which is a part of the Nile River Delta. You see the Nile River flowing this way in the Nile River Delta. Now, the land of Canaan is up here. That will become Israel. But the Israelites have moved from Canaan, and they have come down to the land of Goshen because of the famine. And so it's in the land of Goshen that they settle. And they settle there, and they're welcomed guests in Egypt. But over a period of time, the foreign rulers of Egypt, the Hyksos, are expelled, and the Egyptians take control once more of their own destiny, and they're no longer so happy about all these foreign guests who are staying in their midst. In particular, the Israelites, who have multiplied and multiplied and multiplied, and they're a bit afraid of these people. And in their fear, they decide one way to make sure that these people never gain control or the upper hand in Israel is to oppress them, to make them their slaves. And so when we come to the beginning of the book of Exodus, we find the Israelites have been made slaves in the land of Egypt by the Pharaohs. Now, the story begins by telling us that the Israelites are being pressed into labor, manual labor, to build the royal cities of Pithom and Rameses. And so these two cities, some would say Ramses, probably Rameses. These two cities are being constructed by the Israelites at the command of the Pharaoh. Let's take a look at where those are on your map. Rameses is right here. It's just above Goshen. And just below the term Goshen, at least on my map, is Pithom. So these two cities, Rameses and Pithom. Now, the fact that these two cities are mentioned, Rameses in particular, helps us possibly date when this event occurs. And there's some debate about when the Exodus took place, but Rameses was named after Rameses II, who was the pharaoh who reigned in the 1200s BC. And so if they are working on Rameses and Rameses is a pharaoh, we know that the Exodus would have happened sometime in the 1200s, somewhere between 1290 and maybe 1250 BC in this range of time. Now, as we're looking at this story, what we find is that the Israelites are pressed into service, and they are pressed to build buildings, not the pyramids. The pyramids were built hundreds of years before this. They're pressed into building towns, and they build these towns and the buildings using mud bricks. So they have to make the mud bricks. They mix mud with straw to make the bricks, and then they build the buildings. And if you were to go to Pithom, so if we were to go to the land of Egypt, and I were to take you to Pithom, the ruins of the cities that the Israelites built, the ruins of this particular city can still be seen. Let's take a look at the pictures on the video screen. Now, if you look carefully at these buildings, you'll see that they're built of mud bricks. And if you looked closely at the mud bricks, you would see the places where the straw was mixed in with the mud. And you look at these things and you wonder, could this be some of the very walls and the very bricks that the Israelites were building in the time when they were pressed into slavery and oppressed by the Egyptians? And that was at this time that God heard the cries of the slaves. And in God's hearing their cries, he tapped a man for service, a man named Moses, who was 80 years old already and who was living in a far-off land. Let me show you on the map where Moses was living. Moses at the time is living in the land of Midian. Now, Midian is on the western side of what is today Saudi Arabia. He'd been tending his father-in-law's sheep, and he'd taken them to graze down here by Mount Sinai, which is right here. And so he's grazing the sheep there, and here he sees a burning bush. God calls him. We'll talk more about this story in a moment. And God says, I want you to go to Pharaoh, and I want you to demand of Pharaoh that he release the slaves. They are my people, and I've heard their cries. And after some haggling with Moses, Moses agrees to do this. He makes his way to the city of Rameses, which was now the new capital city of Egypt, and he goes to see the Pharaoh, probably Rameses II. And when he arrives in that city, what he finds are statues of Rameses all over the place, because this is a megalomaniac. He's someone who's enthralled with his own power, and he becomes the longest reigning emperor in Egypt's history, the longest reigning pharaoh. We have a statue behind us that paints a picture, if you will, of Rameses, and you would have found statues like this along with the rest of the body all over Egypt. In fact, you can still see them standing from his time. So Moses goes to confront Rameses in the center of power, the most powerful man on the face of this planet at that time. When he goes to see him, he has a chance to meet him face to face and to make his demand of Rameses. Now, Rameses, the name itself, Mises means born of, Ra is the sun god. And so he claimed Rameses is one who was born of the sun god. He claimed to be divine. And he named his city after himself, Rameses. Now, when Moses goes and approaches the Pharaoh, Moses says, Yahweh, that is the God of Israel, Yahweh says to you that you are to let his people go. And I want you to hear the spirit of Rameses, and as you hear his response, it's found in the book of Exodus. He says, why do I care what Yahweh wants? Who's Yahweh to me? I don't care about him. And so Pharaoh Rameses turns down the request and maintains his grip on the Israelite slaves. In fact, becomes even more oppressive. Now, sometimes we can think of these Bible stories and they seem sort of mythological, like, well, did that really happen? And were there really people like this? You know, what's interesting is several decades ago, the mummy of Rameses was found. And if we were in Egypt right now, I would take you next to the Cairo Museum and we'd have a chance to see what he looks like. And he looks like this. This is Rameses. Actually, you can tell he had red hair. His hair is still red. And this man was the most powerful man on the face of the planet. And Moses faced him and demanded that he let the people go free. Now, some of you might find that a little unsettling to look at this mummy. But I wanted you to see this because I want you to know these are real stories and these were real people and real events in history. They're grounded in people that we can see and buildings that we can see. All right, well, this is what happens next. When Rameses fails to release the people, God says, then I will show you my power. And now we have a face-off between one who claims to be a son of a god and Yahweh himself. And we'll see who's more powerful here. And God brings plague after plague after plague after plague. And first they're nuisances and bothers. And then finally the plagues become more intense. And then they become terrifying. And the very last plague, you remember, is the plague of the firstborn. And it happens on the night of the Passover. And this is what takes place. God tells Moses, Moses, I'm about to ensure that the people are released. In fact, when this night is over, Pharaoh will demand that you leave his presence and take these people away. And this is what will happen. I am going to send the angel of death through the land of Egypt. And he's going to descend upon every household. And the firstborn of every household will die this night. But I want you to tell the Israelites to prepare themselves. I want them to offer a lamb as a sacrifice. Prepare the lamb afterwards and eat their last supper in Egypt. Listen carefully, their last supper in Egypt as slaves. Then I want them to take the blood of the lamb and to put it on the doorpost. And then when the angel of death comes through the land, he will see the blood of the lamb on the doorpost and he will pass over that house and go to the next. And in this way, God says, by the blood of the lamb, after they've eaten the last supper, my children will be saved and then delivered from this land of slavery and bondage. And this is exactly what happens this night. Now, after great wailing and grief throughout Egypt, Pharaoh demands that Moses take these people out of his sight. And the people quickly, frantically gather their things together in the middle of the night, early in the morning, and they make their way out of Egypt and they begin to wander towards the wilderness of Sinai. And when this happens, there wasn't enough time for them to prepare adequate foodstuffs. And so they had dough that was prepared, but it wasn't leavened. And when it came time to bake bread for lunch, there was unleavened bread only to prepare. And so this is what they had to eat, was unleavened bread. And God said to Moses, from this day forward, every year at this time, I want you to help these people remember what I have done for them. They are to celebrate a feast of unleavened bread, a Passover feast. And in their Seder, they will remember that they once were slaves and now they're free. And our Jewish friends continue every year to celebrate that Passover Seder. They're preparing to here in just a couple of weeks, remembering that they once were slaves, but now they're free. Rabbi Amy Katz, a friend of mine, spoke to us and helped us understand how important this particular story I've just recounted to you is for the Jewish people. Take a listen.
It's our story. So we refer to it in our daily literature, in our daily liturgy, every single morning and every single night. We remind ourselves that we were slaves in Egypt and that God let us out. We have not one holiday, but two in which the Exodus is commemorated. Every Friday evening when we recite Kiddush at home, we remind ourselves that we were slaves in Egypt. It's the story that we tell over and over and over again. I believe that something like 92% of American Jews are at a Seder, and a Seder is about the Exodus. The way we tell the story, it's about God hearing our plea and taking us out of Egypt. And what the story means for Jews religiously is God heard us once, God will hear us again. God redeemed us once, God will redeem us again. And I think that's an important part of that story, is about having faith.
I want you to recognize, and hopefully you've already picked up on this, that there are certain parallels between this story and our story. And one of those parallels you've heard already is that this was the Passover Seder, was the very first one, was a Last Supper, is slaves before they were set free. And every year after that, the Passover Seder would be a meal that would commemorate God's central saving act for his people and how he had delivered them from slavery. You know, of course, that Jesus, when he was eating his Last Supper with his disciples, it was the Passover Seder, according to the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And he ate this meal with them, and he transformed its meaning. And he said, now this bread, unleavened bread, which once was a reminder of how God set us free from Egypt, slavery, now will be a reminder of my body, which is broken or crucified for you. And this wine will be a reminder of my blood, which was shed for you. And every time that you eat this meal, I want you to remember that you once were slaves to sin and death, and now you've been set free. And so the Christian Holy Communion is patterned after the Passover Seder. Now, when we leave this, coming back to the story, when we leave the land of Egypt, this night the slaves would gather their things together, and that next morning they would take off. And I want you to have a picture of where they were coming from and where they were going. This is a NASA-supplied photograph of the land of Egypt from space. You'll see the Nile River and the Nile River Delta. And the people were in Ramesses, and they were in Pithom. And Moses led them that night. They gathered their things, and the next morning they gathered together and they began their march. They crossed what may have been the Reed Sea or a small body of water. And as they did, they went the southern route through the Sinai Peninsula. And they traveled down through the wilderness until they came once more to the mountain of God, Mount Horeb. It's also called Mount Sinai. And it's also now called Mount Moses. And they journeyed to this place. Now, I want you to have a sense of what that journey might have looked like and what they would have seen. You'll see in the photograph on the video screen what that wilderness looked like. It's a beautiful land, absolutely beautiful, and yet also very, very barren. And you'll see all the Israelites were traveling here, and they were traveling to Mount Sinai. In the next photograph, you'll see Mount Sinai. And this is from the base of Mount Sinai. St. Catherine's Monastery is located there. And there was lightning, and there was thunder, and there was fire and clouds up on the top of the mountain. And Moses ascended that mountain to meet with God while the people were terrified down below, waiting. And I wonder, do you remember how long Moses was up there on the mountain, fasting and spending time with God, receiving the commandments? 40 days and 40 nights he fasted and prayed on the top of the mountain, receiving the commandments, the covenant that God made with his people through the commandments. Do you remember how long Jesus fasted and prayed in the wilderness at the beginning of his ministry? 40 days and 40 nights. We're in the season of Lent. It's 40 days and 40 nights of Lent in which we're marking that period of time in which Jesus was fasting. Jesus and Moses, there's a parallel here. Do you remember that Moses went up on the mountaintop to receive the Ten Commandments? When Jesus went to preach his most famous sermon, where did he preach it from? It was the Sermon on the Mount, the Sermon on the Mount. You see the parallels that are happening back and forth here. In any case, this is where the people are. Moses is at the top of the mountain. He receives the Ten Commandments from God. He receives the other laws. God enters into a covenant with his people and the people with God, and they agree to follow him and to obey his commandments, and he will be their God, and God will be he will be their God, and they will be his people. Now, the Ten Commandments. We learn 60% of all Americans don't know more than five, maybe not even five of the Ten Commandments. I wonder how many do you know? If I were to hand you a microphone right now, say, could you name the Ten Commandments? Would you get them all? And would you get them in the right order? Well, I tested myself on this. I got them all, but I had them at least two of them in the wrong order. And so probably I'm guessing a few of you might get them wrong. I'm not going to walk through all of them right now. I'm going to ask you to write down this on your sermon notes. Write down Exodus 20. Exodus chapter 20. And I'd like to invite you to go home tonight and to read Exodus chapter 20, the Ten Commandments. And then I'd like for you to ask this question. How am I doing on obeying them? All right, so am I keeping them, and what are they? And my hope is that you get an A on the Ten Commandments quiz. So I'd like for you to have a chance to know them. I want to encourage you to read them on your own tonight. All right, the first half of Exodus is the deliverance from slavery in Egypt. The second half of Exodus is the giving of the law. The book of Leviticus is the giving of the law. So for a year, the Israelites were camped out at Mount Sinai. God gives them the law. That's the book of Exodus, the book of Leviticus. Then in the book of Numbers, the people of Israel began marching towards the Promised Land. They get just to the outskirts of the Promised Land, and they send spies into the land to look it over. And the spies come back and say, the people there are like giants. They're too strong for us, and they will destroy us. Moses, why'd you bring us out here to die? Take us back to Egypt. And with this, God becomes angered with the people. He says, did you all not get it? I delivered you from the most powerful force on the face of this planet, and you don't think I can deliver the land of Canaan to you? How long will I put up with this unbelieving generation? And God says, not one of the people who's alive now who resisted going into the promised land will get to see it with their own eyes. And so God caused the Israelites to wander for 40 years through the wilderness so that that generation would die out. And so at the end of Numbers, the people are right at the edge of the promised land. They've wandered for 40 years, and now they have made their way into or to the outskirts of the promised land. So they were down at Mount Sinai. They wandered for 40 years in all kinds of different places. They finally come up, and they're right here at Mount Nebo, just on the east side of the Jordan River and the Dead Sea. And it's there that the book of Deuteronomy takes place. And Deuteronomy takes place as Moses is giving his final words before he dies to the Israelites as they're going into the promised land. They're right there getting ready to enter. And the next week, the sermon will focus on Joshua and what happens when they enter into the promised land. Moses doesn't get to go into the promised land. He goes to the top of Mount Nebo. And from Mount Nebo, God allows him to see the promised land from the top of the mountain before Moses dies. And this is the view he had from the top of Mount Nebo, looking over into the promised land. So this is what you'd see. This photo was taken from Mount Nebo, and this is what Moses saw. And then Moses died, and God received him into his arms and into his loving care. All right. That's a little bit of what you'd see if you took this journey with the Israelites. What I'd like to do now in the time that remains is think about Moses and part of his story. I want to remind you of a few details about Moses. Now, there's not a lot we have, just a couple of chapters about Moses' background until the age of 80. But what we do have tells us this, that Moses is the first person in all the Bible who was given up for adoption. Moses was given up by his mother for adoption. She gave him up because she could not save him. And she placed him in a basket and left him for an Egyptian woman to find. And it ended up being an Egyptian princess who lived in Pharaoh's house, one of Pharaoh's daughters. And so by giving up her son for adoption, she actually saved her son. Now, it was interesting, if you read the story, how it was that she still had access to the son and later on taught him about his own heritage, that he was an Israelite. Now, this boy was named Moses, or in Egyptian, Mises. Now, in Hebrew, Moses means something like drawn out of the water, but in Egyptian, it means son of. And so we had Ra-Mises, who is the son of the god Ra, and then there was Tut-Mises, Tut-Moses, and that is the son of the god Tut. And so there were these kinds of names, Ah-Moses, the son of Amun. But in the case of Moses, his name was simply Mises, born of, with no one that identifies who he was born of. In other words, the name the Egyptians gave him was a name that said, you have no family. We've taken you into our home, but you have no father. You have no family. And so his name reminded him his whole life that he was adopted and that the family that took him in didn't necessarily consider him one of their children. So this is Moses. Now, God used the fact that he was adopted in that household to do profound things, and it was because of that act and his mother's willingness to give him, to save him in this way, that he was able to become the savior of the Israelite people. So this is what we find is in his childhood. Now, he grows up, and as a young man, he knows that he's an Israelite in Egypt's, in the Pharaoh's household, and he goes out, and we hear the story that he's watching over the slaves in Egypt, and he's troubled by this. He's upset by the injustice and the oppression that's happening to the slaves. And one day he's watching and there's an Egyptian who's beating an Israelite. And Moses rushes up to him and he strikes the man and he kills him. Moses kills a man. And he becomes a fugitive from the law. And he has to leave Egypt. Now, what does that tell you, this story? It tells you that in his heart, he was angered by the oppression and the injustice that was committed against his people. And he longed to do something about it. He longed to make things right. And yet the path that he took didn't lead there. Instead, he ran and he fled into the land of Midian, far away. Now, in the land of Midian, he met a woman and he got married and he had children. And we don't hear from him again for 50 years. For 50 years. That's what I want to focus on for a moment. What happened during those 50 years to Moses? What happened in the silent years? Now, the Israelites continued to be oppressed, and Moses' older brother and sister, he knew, continued to be oppressed back in the land of Egypt. But somehow Moses got married, he had children, he settled into a career, and he seems not to be thinking about the oppression of the Israelites for that 50-year period of time. He somehow dealt with that by not thinking about it. It's somebody else's responsibility. It's too hard to go back. It's too difficult. He suppresses all the dreams he once had of changing the world, and he no longer thinks about that anymore. Until he's 80 years old. I want us to think about this for a moment. I don't know about you, but when I was young, I had lots of dreams about changing the world. And when I saw injustice, it made me angry. And I had pretty strong opinions about things. And I know it's hard for you to imagine that, but I had strong opinions about things and didn't hesitate to speak out. And I didn't mind taking risks in order to try to change things. That's how I was. That's how I saw things at times. And I look today at my life and I wonder sometimes if I have lost that. If it's gotten softened a little bit over time. I look at my daughter, my 20-year-old, who's in college, and you know, she's studying political science at K-State, and she's got real strong opinions about things, and she wants to change the world. And this summer, she wants to go down and work in South Africa for 2 months among many of the poorest people there. And the more challenging and dangerous, the more exciting it is to her, and she can't wait to go. And you know, all I'm thinking about is, will she be safe? Is it okay for you to go there? And I'm thinking about, how are you going to have money for college next semester if you're working down there for free in South Africa? These are the questions that are going through my mind. She's going to change the world. I'm worried about finances and safety. Are you with me? One of our staff members came to me this week. This Friday, LaVon and I, Danielle and Rebecca, and five other members of our church are taking a trip to the Ukraine and to Siberia. And we will be, some of our team will be working with street kids in downtown Kiev, and some of our team will be doing leadership training and development. That's part of what I'm doing, is to try to train the pastors and the leaders in the Ukraine and in Siberia and to encourage them so that their churches can grow. And we're excited about this. And one of our staff came to me and said, Adam, I just want you to know that in Siberia, we're probably going to have the pastors who are there. There's several hundred, I think, pastors who are coming, Baptists, Pentecostals, Methodists, for our leadership training. They're probably going to be staying in a hotel that's not very nice. It's near the church, and it's convenient, and it's cheap, but it's not very nice. And in my head, I thought, oh, no. Because, you see, I've been to Russia three other times, and I've stayed in nice hotels there, and they're not very nice. So when somebody tells me that the pastors there are going to stay in a not very nice hotel, I'm immediately going, oh, wonder what that means. And then they said, but Pastor Sergey over there, he wants to make sure that our team is staying in the nicer hotel on the other end of Tumen. And I said, great, good. And then they said, oh, but we told him you wouldn't want to do that. Because you would want to stay where the other pastors were, and you wouldn't want to stay in a nicer place than they were staying at. And I was so ashamed. And I thought, what happened to me? Why did my staff member have to realize that and I'd forgotten it? And when did I decide that comfort was really the most important thing, or convenience or safety, and stop being willing to sacrifice and to pay some price? When did that happen? And it seems like for many of us, somewhere along the way, comfort, convenience, safety, we become risk averse. We become afraid of what other people are going to think about us. We begin to worry, what would our boss think if we said this, if we did this, if we took this stand, if we actually let people know how we were feeling? Well, what would happen then? And I think that's what happened to Moses during those 50 years. I think that's why he was silent. He got married, he had kids, he had a career, and he stopped being willing to risk, and he forgot his dreams until he was 80 years old. And at the age of 80, he's in the middle of the wilderness all by himself. And you know, all the dreams he had as a kid, he's realized he's never going to accomplish those things. And he's out there, but he's also realized, you know what, he didn't have to impress anybody anymore. And he's set probably in terms of his retirement. And so he's got nothing to lose anymore either. And at this point, he begins to hear that dream coming back, welling up in his heart again. He sees a burning bush and he hears a voice from God, and it says, Moses, I'm paraphrasing now, Moses, you remember those people back in Egypt? Do you remember those Israelites? Because I never forgot them, Moses. And I hear their cries. And I'm calling you to go and demand that Pharaoh set them free. Now, part of what I find fascinating in this story is Moses' response to this. Because Moses' response probably looks a lot like our response. And Moses begins to argue with God and says, Lord, who am I to go do that? I mean, I'm a nobody. I'm a shepherd out here. I'm a fugitive from the law. Come on, God. Find someone else. God says, no, you're exactly the person I want to send. He says, Lord, come on. You know, the Israelites wouldn't believe me. Who's going to believe me? Really, I'm going to tell them that I saw a burning bush and, you know, I heard a voice and Yahweh told me to go. Nobody's going to believe that, Lord. Please find somebody else. Moses, they'll believe you. Trust me. Okay, Lord, listen. Just listen. I stutter when I'm in front of people. I get nervous when I'm around them and I just can't talk. My tongue gets all twisted up. God, I'm not going to be able to talk in front of Pharaoh. Please send somebody else. Moses, I gave you your tongue. I'm going to make sure it works right. And then finally, he leaves off all excuses. Moses simply says, the last thing he says, Lord, please send someone else. And I love this about Moses. He's so human. He's just like us. You know, and this is sort of what happens with us. We begin to feel this sense of, you know what? That's right. Somebody ought to stand up. Somebody ought to go work with the poor. Somebody ought to go, I got to go work for justice over here. Somebody ought to work with the kids in Vacation Bible Camp so we can welcome other unchurched kids. Somebody ought to do that. Somebody else. I don't want to make you feel guilty. Actually, I want to build you up a bit. But last week, I announced, you know, our dream of having 500 kids to come here for Vacation Bible Camp who are unchurched, and that we needed 150 new volunteers more than we've had in the past. And we had our signups for Vacation Bible Camp last week for teachers. And you know what? We had the best response we've ever had. I mean, it was the best first weekend sign up. I was so proud of you. We had somewhere between 350 and 400 people sign up to teach Vacation Bible Camp. But we still need 150 more people. We need 550 to 600 in order to be able to welcome those kids. And I think we'll get there. I think we'll get there. But here's what I was thinking about. Is last week, there were 8,000 people in worship. And I made this appeal in all the services. And 7,600 of those 8,000 said, you know, somebody ought to do that. Somebody else. Now, we don't need 8,000 of you to do that. I'm not trying to give you a guilt trip. I'm just trying to say this is our human nature. Is we always think somebody else will take care of it. Somebody should do something. You know, God hears the cries of the Israelites. Somebody ought to do something. God says, yeah, you. You. I want to encourage you to be listening for God's voice and what God's going to call you to do. Now, I love this story. Moses finally has no more excuses, and he agrees to go. So at the age of 80, he agrees to go. And along the way, God brings his older brother, Aaron, who's 83. And part of what they realize, they're going to confront Pharaoh, and they realize, you know what? We've got nothing to lose. Why not? This is what I want to say to our elders who are here in this service, those of you who are retirement age, let's say, and beyond, is that sometimes you have to lead the rest of us. Sometimes you have to say, you know what? I've got nothing left to lose. I can do that. I'll stand up, and I don't care what my neighbors think anymore. I don't have to please a boss anymore. I can stand up for what's right. I can actually risk going places that might be kind of scary. I was invited to a country in Africa several years ago that's in the midst of a civil war, and the bishop of the Methodist church there said, would you come and teach our Methodist pastors? And I was afraid to go. I mean, I'm kind of ashamed to admit that. And I wrote the bishop back and I said, you know, when my kids are graduating from high school, would you please invite me again? But I feel like I need to be here just in case something were to happen, and I know it probably won't. But at what point are we in a place in our lives where we can say, you know what? Send me to the dangerous places. Send me to the places that are hard. Send me to the places that it's unpopular to go to, or that people aren't going to like if I take this stand. Send me, Lord, here I am. And sometimes it requires people like you who are elders who can lead us in that and show us once more. I think it's the young people and it's the seniors who might have a chance to pull the rest of us along. Several years ago, it was just before the Iraq War, and I was speaking in another part of the country. I was in a hotel room by myself late one night, and I turned on C-SPAN, and I was watching the debate in the Senate between the senators as to whether we should go to war or not. And I was fascinated by this, and I was particularly fascinated by Senator Robert Byrd, who stood up to take the podium from Virginia. And he's he's the oldest member of the Senate. And I watched as he took, you know, as he moved very slowly, and he came to the microphone, and he began to speak. And you could hear a pin drop in the room. And because of his age, he was able to say things that no one else could say. And whether you agree with his politics or not, just watching this picture of this white-haired man who is standing before his senators and his fellow senators and chastising them in both parties and saying, it is not unpatriotic to ask questions. And I have been through this too many times over the last 50 years to see what the results of this kind of action are going to be. And I have to say, I don't care if I get reelected or not. I don't care what my constituents might say. I have to speak my mind on this, and this is what I think. Now, this is a picture of Senator Robert Byrd. And you may be aware of the fact that that he is third in line for the presidency right now. If Dick Cheney died and something happened to Nancy Pelosi, this is the man who would be your president. And he turns 90 in November. And he's served for 50 years in the Senate. And he's not afraid to say what he thinks. Seniors, lead us. Don't spend your last chapter of your life hitting golf balls and playing it safe. Now it's time to take some risks if you never have before. That's what Moses did. Now, I want to end with this idea. The reason why Moses was able to do this, and this was God's response to Moses. Moses was able to go, and you know, here's the thing. God didn't say, Moses, go to Pharaoh, and it's all going to work out peachy keen. God didn't say that. You know what God said? He said, go to Pharaoh, and I will be with you. He didn't say, Moses, when you go there, you're not going to be thrown in jail. He said, Moses, go there, and I will be with you. He didn't say, Moses, you're not going to die of a heart attack on the way back across the desert. He said, Moses, I will be with you. He didn't say, Moses, they're not going to kill you in Egypt when you go back. He said, Moses, I will be with you. That was God's answer. That's always God's answer. I mean, that's what David says. He says, yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. Why? Because thou art with me. When Jesus says, go into all the world and make disciples, and some of you will be killed for your faith, and you'll be hauled before the courts, go ahead and go anyway. Why? He says, because lo, I will be with you always, even to the end of the age. He will be with you when you take a tough stand. He will be with you when you go into a part of the city you're a bit afraid of. He will be with you when you go on that mission trip that you're not certain about. He will be with you. And somehow, however it works out, it's going to be okay, because he's with you. I end with a story. This week I was in the Memphis airport. I was flying to Chattanooga to speak to a conference of pastors. And on the way, I have a cell phone that gives me my email. My assistant Sue had forwarded me an email from someone in our congregation who said, Pastor Adam, would you please pray for our son-in-law, Scott? He lives in another city, and he visits the church when he's in Kansas City. He loves the church, and he just found out that he has an inoperable brain tumor. Would you please pray for him? And I did. I stopped and I prayed for him in the airport, and then I thought, I think I should call him. I didn't know this man. I've never met him before. Just something inside me said I should call him. And at the bottom of the email, hardly ever does this happen, but they included his phone number. And so I called him. And I said, Scott, I don't know if you remember me. I'm Pastor Adam Hamilton. I'm at the Church of the Resurrection. And he said, I can't believe you're calling me. Yes, I know who you are. And I said, tell me what's going on. And he told me about his condition. He told me about his family, his wife, his two children, 4 and 6 years old. And the prognosis is not good. And I said, Scott, I wish I could wave a magic wand and make this go away. I will be praying for you. And I will tell you that I have seen God do amazing things. And you have good doctors, and they're going to use the medical treatment that they have, and we're going to pray that God uses that. And I've seen God do great things, and people be so surprised at how everything worked out. And that's what we're going to pray for you. But I wish I had that magic wand to make it all okay. I said, tell me about your faith, Scott. And he said, Adam, I'm one of those people that you started your church for. I'm non-religious or nominally religious, and that's part of why I like coming to Church of the Resurrection. Is when I come there, I feel like I kind of get it. You know, and I start to understand some things about God, and I enjoy being there when I'm there, but that's kind of who I am, and I'm open, and I'm seeking, and I'm trying to find out the truth. And I said, well, I'm going to offer you the only thing I know to give you as a pastor is what the Bible teaches us. And that is that I don't know what your future holds, and we're going to pray for the shrinking of this tumor and that it disappears. And that may be the course of action, or it may not be, but that's what we're going to pray for. But here's what the Bible says. The Bible says that when we trust in him, God is going to be with us always. Always. And I said, you know, I know that maybe that's troubling to try to figure out if you can put your trust in that or not. But here's what I know after working with thousands of people is I know the people who are able to trust that God is with them and that he's got them in his arms and he's going to walk with them no matter what have a peace that those who can't trust that never seem to find. And I said, you have 2 children, 4 and 6. I remember when my girls were 4 and 6 years old. And I said, you know, one of the funny things was when they would, not just funny, just endearing, is in the middle of the night when they'd have a bad dream, they'd run down the hallway and then they'd be pushing on me and say, Daddy, are you awake? Are you awake? Or Mommy, are you awake? I had a bad dream. Or when there was a thunderstorm and it was scary and you'd count on the fact that they were going to be down in the room, Mommy, Daddy, I'm scared. There's a thunderstorm or a tummy ache. And we would wake up. And we would take them and pick them up, and there was a little couch, a little love seat in our bedroom, and we would lay them on the love seat, and I would get down on my knees, or LaVon would do the same, and we would hold their hand. We'd say, honey, we're right here. Daddy's right here. Mommy's right here. It's okay. And we would pray with them, and they would close their eyes, and before you knew it, they'd be sound asleep. Same thunderstorm going on outside. Maybe the same potential nightmare that might come back. The only thing that changed that allowed them to have peace was that they knew their mommy or their daddy was right there. That's part of the message of the books of Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. God hears the cry of those who are oppressed. God cares about justice. God uses people to do his work in this world. God takes people who are older and often will use them as his instruments for accomplishing his purposes. And we don't have to be afraid because God is with us. Let's pray. Oh God, we give you thanks and praise for the story of Moses and the Exodus, that you cared about those slaves in Egypt, that you heard their cries, that you sent Moses to confront Pharaoh, that Moses, even after arguing with you, was finally willing to say yes, that you were with him when he went, that you displayed your power and your strong arm delivered the Israelites from slavery. We give you thanks and praise for this. We thank you that you demonstrated your presence with them in visible ways through the Passover Seder, through the Ark of the Covenant, through the Tabernacle or Tent of Meeting. All of these reminded the people that you were with them. Lord, we thank you that you sent your Son, Jesus Christ, to call us to follow him, to do what was dangerous and risky sometimes, what was unpopular, and to do that in your name, knowing that you would be with us. Help us, O Lord, help this congregation be filled with courageous and bold Christians, willing to serve you, willing to do what was unpopular, willing to take risks for your name. And, O God, no matter what we face, no matter where we go, help us always remember that you are with us. Comfort us in this, O God. Encourage us and give us strength. In Jesus' name, amen.